Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is George Armistead, and we are Life List, a birding podcast. I am here with my good bud, co-host, Alvaro Jaramillo. Alvaro, what is happening?
Hey, how's it going? You know, have you ever wondered, George, why it's like, you know, we had to put Life List, a birding podcast, you know, like, do people like tune in and go, I expected a banking podcast or, you know, I expected knitting when I came to Life List. I wonder what other things Life List like brings you to, you know, like if you're at the wrong place, like what is it, you know, if it's not birding?
Well, you know, it's funny because I don't know the answer to that, but like if I'm doing our social media and I do like hashtag Life List, I've never really looked at this, but if I do just hashtag Life List, it's something that existed before our podcast, which it like outside of a birding context.
Right.
And I want to say that there's like some fishing thing or something.
Interesting.
But as I just Google Life List here, there's quite a bit of stuff that is not really bird related.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like stuff I want to do before I die, sort of like bucket list stuff related.
I'm surprised too, where I use sometimes hashtag birds and wine for some of my tours, right? And you click on birds and wine and you get a bunch of people, you know, just drinking wine, no bird at all. Sometimes it's
birds on the label.
Yeah. Then I realized it was always women, and it was probably British women drinking wine. So there were birds in wine. And I'm like, oh, you know, I had to like dig deep with my resources to figure out what it all meant. But
hey, anyway. There's also a movie, Alvaro, The Life List.
Oh.
The summary being, a woman revisits her childhood aspirations, endeavoring to achieve her old goals, only to discover that pursuing these lifelong dreams takes her on an unforeseen and surprising journey. My goodness, what a bait and hook. We might have to check that out.
Check that out. We could do like one of those, you know, we all sit in a theater, watch it, and comment on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, like sort of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 exactly. Kind of style.
Yes. Yeah, sort of, or you know, or Beavis and Butthead and Molly, mm-hmm. You know, so it's like sort of one of those things. Have you ever thought about the fact that you have a bucket list and then you kick the bucket at the end? Isn't that
weird? I think that's the idea, right? It's like,
and why a bucket? Like,
that I couldn't tell you.
I mean, I think they're two independent things, and they just happen to be associated with a life.
Hmm.
Anyway, how you doing?
Dude, I'm struggling here. It's been raining for 2 days straight, and then today it's pouring again. So we're on day three of just rain. And like, you know, it's getting late in the day here. It's midday for you, I know. So you've got your mate and you're sipping from the bombilla there. And I meanwhile poured myself actually a little Pinot Noir here because frankly, it's been a rough couple days.
It has been.
And now all of a sudden we're getting thunder. Like,
wow.
It's pretty weird to have 2 days of like, yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow, that's nice. I should have seen that coming. But is that AC/DC? AC/DC, yes. Well, that would be one of the ultimate bands to see live, I would say, especially back in the day. But anyway, suffice it to say, I'm getting a little cabin fever in here. Dan, our buddy Dan Lane, came for a visit. I just dropped him off the train station this morning. And we actually did something kind of interesting. We went to chase the red-flanked blue tail.
Oh, the New Jersey blue tail.
Yeah, which, you know, showed up in early December at the end of 2023. And
they put out cookies for the birders.
Well, I got to say, the owner of that house and that's been hosting the birders there is really, it's a fantastic couple, a super, super nice dude. Like, so generous, so hospitable, funny, smart, like really, we did not see the blue tail. The last record of the blue tail was 2 days before we were there. It has not been seen since by anybody, including the owner of the place. Huh. But he made, we spent about 90 minutes in rain waiting for this thing to appear. But the owner of the place there really made the time pass. One thing I thought, you know, Dan was asking him a lot of questions about what it was like to host this vagrant bird, you know, and find it as well. He was the finder of this bird. And I will say, walking up to the place, one of the neighbors there, I was in the spot. We'd followed the directions as to where to park, how to access this area. And Dan kind of went to check on, you know, there was kind of two points from which people were looking for this, you know, had been seeing this thing. So he went to one side. I was like, I'll hang here. You check the other side. I'm there and a guy rolls up in a Jeep and he's like, private property. And I was like, yep, I understand. You know, like basically I'd read the directions. I knew where I was supposed to be and where I was not allowed to be. And I was on the edge of the road, not on anybody's lawn. And he was like, and he looks at me and he goes, well, it looks like you don't understand. And then he gave me quite an earful about, you know.
Is that the moment you say, hold on, you may not know who you're talking to here, but you may know me from Lifeless, a birding podcast.
Oh, I can guarantee you he is not a listener. Nor would he be impressed with probably anything we had to say. But at any rate, let's just say he was not the most welcoming of neighbors.
New Jersey's known for the welcoming people. So,
Well, the funny thing is, actually, like to that point, before I saw this guy, like four or five other neighbors had driven by, and they were all waving, like, "Yep, you know, we get it. We know that you're a birder. We know why you're here. Yeah. Enjoy, you know, knock yourselves out." And then this guy rolls up, and it was like about as unpleasant as he possibly could have been. But
the Jeep. That's it.
Yeah, he was red.
He was so uncomfortable in that Jeep.
I'll bet some other people had some conversations with him. But we then went to the owner's house where he actually had put out some mealworms, and that guy was amazing. He was fantastic. His wife offered us coffee and everything. Really, really fantastic couple. And I also thought it was cool. Dan was asking him about what his experience was like hosting this bird, and he said it had been life-changing. Like he was like, you know, yes, there were some bad actors. There were some people that did not follow the rules, the requests of the property owners around there. You know, there was even one incident where the police had to be called in, and that was bad. But he said, despite all that, he was like, I've always been a casual birder, but this has been a life-changing experience. He's like, I think about it, I get choked up. It's such a fantastic group of people. Gee. They got together, one of the local, kind of authorities on birds in the region put together a fund for him, and they got him a new pair of binoculars. They, you know, a bunch of people put together money so that he could get seed and everything. And he was overwhelmed at this community, which he's kind of felt like adopted by, that he brought into his house at the same time. So that part was really cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, you go from the Jeep guy to the nicest human on the planet has had life changed by this rare bird all in one go. Kind of a summary of humanity, isn't it?
It really is. Birding is increasingly a microcosm of the rest of society. It used to be kind of a weird subculture, but really now I think it's actually pretty representative of a lot of society.
Yeah. That's really cool. One quick point. Dan can discover or, you know, I mean, I should say describe brand new species to the world, yet he doesn't know to go earlier to go see the blue tail to see it. I'm upset that he didn't know any better.
Yeah, everybody was disappointed in him for that. Yes. Yeah.
Well,
you know, it was my first time there, Al, and I lived like less than 90 minutes away from the place. So, but it was interesting just to see this.
90 minutes is a long time, you know?
Yeah, well, it is. I do wish I'd gone a little bit earlier, but, after talking to the owner, he was like, you know, it showed up, I think he said December 5th last year. He's like, when early December rolls around this year, he was like, if this thing shows up again somehow and returns to winter in the same area, he was like, I'm going to be out of my skull. You know, but they'd had actually, you know, what Dan did represent was his first known observer from Louisiana. And I think they said they'd had something like 30 states, people from 30 states come visit.
I still think of Dan as a guy from New Jersey, but I guess
I do too.
So long ago.
Yeah, you know? I mean, at this point in his life, he's probably spent half his life in Louisiana, maybe more. So,
yeah, interesting. I got two things that came up, but one of them was a rare bird that I had. Well, the 90-minute drive is what you know tipped me off on this. Is that about 40-minute drive from here? There's a piping plover. You have to go.
Big news.
Big news for California. I guess the 6th or 7th record or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But the crazy thing is that it was posted as a. There had been, like, for a couple of years, which makes you wonder if it's the same bird or not. A dilute, you know, kind of like a pale,
leucistic, but
yeah.
Pigment challenged.
Yeah. Semi-palmated plover in the area. And then it was reported as a semi-palmated plover, you know, dilute,
dilute plumage.
And, yeah. And then I looked at it and I was just like, you know, yeah, that's what it looks like, but it looks fat. And, you know, to me, like, piping plover is like this big, fat, round bird. I was just like, you know, somebody should just go and check this out again, you know, like just really see it and get good looks. And I think everybody's bought into it now that it's a piping plover, you know.
It's pretty wild. I saw like the first image, I think, that was shared of that kind of broadly where it's flying with semi-palmated plovers.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is an identification challenge I never really thought of before.
No.
Like in the photo,
obvious, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In the photo, you're like, oh yeah, but wait, is it? And then like, once you look at more photos, it becomes a lot more clear, which is again, something that all birders should get used to, is multiple photos way better than one photo.
Yeah. But I have not gone to see it. And I was just, you know, I'm going to pull a Dan maybe. And there's going to be a, you know, later if it hangs in for a while and it becomes really reliable and whatever. There's a lot of other birds to see there, so I might go. But I'm just sort of lazy on it. But I feel kind of, you know, happy that my little, you know, sometimes you just put something out, you just go like, you know, maybe somebody should check this out again. You know, not even, I had no assured. Nothing. It just looked odd, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that everybody's coming back and saying it is a piping plover, I'm pretty happy about, but you know, just cause it's made a lot of people happy.
Yeah.
Now if somebody can figure out that it isn't a piping plover for some reason, just don't let anybody know. Cause you're going to make it sad again. You know? So just like, you know? Then the other thing I was thinking about, you said weather, you know, everybody's going to this, eclipse next week. And I'm looking at the weather, and I think you're better off being in Buffalo than Texas. And
we have a tour going.
I know. I'm like, I can see the stress on your face. But, you know,
taking the Buffalo. I was telling, you know, our guides, Holly Merker and Whitney Lanfranco, with our group of eight folks. I mean, we've been planning this a long time. And I was like, Holly, Whitney, I feel like I'm sending off a couple soldiers into a real battle here. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's challenging enough with just the logistics. I mean, it's really been a challenge to set this trip up with, you know, some rolling challenges. And now all of a sudden you look at the weather and like, you know, when they started showing weather maps like months ago of what the odds of like good viewing would be, and like, you know, Central Texas was not only the closest to the center of totality and the longest period of totality, but it was also by far and away the highest chance of having good clear skies. And now, yeah. I was going to say, like, we might have better viewing here. We're not going to be in totality here in Philadelphia. I think we're still at 90%, but we might have better viewing here than in Texas.
How close are you to like driving to totality?
not that far.
Totality. I would drive to totality.
Yeah.
That's a totality. that's a weird thing to say.
It is. Yeah. Totally weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I, We're not that far. Western Pennsylvania, extreme Western Pennsylvania. I have friends going to Erie, you know, Erie County, Lake Erie, and Presque Isle State Park. That is going to, my nephew also is going out there to be in the path. They're driving to totality. And, Yeah. And, so they're driving to totality and they actually, the way the weather looks right now, they might actually, you know, have a good experience. We'll see. Huh,
nice. Yeah. I'm planning 2027. There's a eclipse in Spain. Going to do a tour.
Oh man.
Everybody get together for that one. That's going to be a good one. Cause you can sit there and if it's cloudy, which is unlikely cause it's Spain, you can drink wine and have jamón and queso.
That does sound pretty good. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Maybe we should make a big event.
I like that idea. Yeah. I think that you're talking sense there.
It lends itself, you know, the fact that you can, you know, you all kind of congregate on a place during the eclipse, you know, and you can do, yeah, let's think about it.
Yeah.
Lifeless eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all that came up. I got nothing now.
Yeah. But we dipped on that blue tail. Hopefully we will not dip on the eclipse, any of us, all of us that want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Al, there was a couple things I thought we should chat about today. One is a project you were involved with, which is a couple weeks back published in Birding Magazine. Was the 34th report of the ABA Checklist Committee for 2023. Included highlights of a couple new additions to the ABA Checklist Committee. So this is a list of birds in the American Birding Association area, which is pretty much the United States and Canada.
Yeah.
And
includes Hawaii, of course.
Yes, you know. Yep. And I don't know if it still includes some of those islands in like Canada, like those French islands, but
Okay. St. Pierre and Miquelon.
Yes, okay. New additions with the big news was what? Western Marsh Harrier, mm-hmm. Siberian House Martin, and Icterine Warbler were added. Those were fun new additions. You are on this committee along with the chair, Peter Pyle, Luke DeChico, our buddy Doug Gotchfeld, Andy Kratter from Florida, Mark Lockwood, Marky Mutchler, who is somebody I've scheduled twice to have on the podcast, but we've had scheduling issues. I'm looking forward to getting Marky on here. And also some other guy, I think his name's David Sibley. It looks like this gentleman is also on this committee. So I'm joking, of course. David Sibley is an amazing human and amazing contributor to birding and ornithology in North American history. So those were some big additions. There were also some species not added to the ABA Checklist Committee. News on various fronts. First of all, what was your experience like in the voting process here? Maybe tell folks a little bit about that.
I think there's also, George, you know, a kind of like interim report online that has some newer info than this, I think. I'm trying to like remember because I think here the Goonlocks, it hasn't been
It's in that
yet, isn't it? It's in, or is it?
I thought it had been. Yeah,
it had been. Yeah, I guess I think it was sort of like still on the. It's got a question mark, but it now is officially not accepted. So I think there's some other thing here that it wasn't published yet on Birding, but it was on the website.
Uh huh.
But in any case, here's my thing, like. I think a lot of people are going to be angry at me.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the Goonlocks hawk, that it did not get accepted. And I was also partially Yeah, one of the people who was not keen on the variable hawk.
Boo, hiss.
You know? I was fine with the black catbird and it being ship assisted, but it was not accepted.
He's insufferable, everybody. I'm sorry. I apologize on behalf of Lifelist.
And I got to say, though, if anybody wants me off that committee, you know, you're just angry, write letters, tell your representatives, your ABA folks, I will gladly step down
from
the committee because, you know, it's just the heat. The heat's too much for me. Mm-hmm. I just can't take it, you know. No, but the thing that I've thought was interesting is that the logic at which we go about accepting or not some of these records is so
subjective.
Subjective, yeah. Like for me, seeing a Gunlax hawk type looking thing sitting on a roof was just like, I don't know. You know, we've talked about it before. It's just, I've never seen a Gunlax hawk in Cuba doing this kind of thing. Then you start looking at photographs of Cooper's hawks and you realize they're pretty variable. And some of them approach the look of this guy. So I'm like, you know what? That's enough concern for me to sort of say, yeah, let's
to be cautious,
hold off, right? But there are other, you know, so that is subjective. And some people would say, a dumb way to look at this record, right? And then other people on the committee were saying a certain hurricane had gone by and, you know, it went right by that part of, it sort of tracked between the two sites, you know, Cuba and Florida. But I'm like, you know, when are we going to stop
with the hurricanes?
You know, the hurricanes do certain things, right? Like the flamingo thing we can explain. Vagrants, you know, or things that are entrapped in the eye that are usually terns and seabirds and migratory warblers and stuff, or things that do downwind, you know, they're migrating and then they hit this wind and they go downwind dispersal kind of thing. But to actually have resident bird just picked up, you know, it's you know, a little palm tree or something going, oh man, I'm going to die.
That doesn't
and then it
often.
Gets picked up by the hurricane and deposited hundreds of miles away, it just doesn't happen. Like if it does, it's like a 1 in 10 million.
Right. I'm sure it has happened, but it cannot explain
the
vast number of vagrants that people try to use it for.
Yeah. And I feel like that is also subjective in its own right. And even the fact that, you know, I think that it doesn't happen, there's a subjectivity to it all, right? Like, and yet it sounds weirdly logical when you put it together. The hurricane came through here, went through there. The bird is probably still stunned from 2 weeks ago when it was in the hurricane. Therefore, it's, you know, on a roof.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, the story makes sense, but it's a story. And it actually, I don't buy it.
It's bordering on a conspiracy theory.
Right.
Yeah.
And we do that all the time in birding, like all of us, not just the committee member. We all do it, right? And I think the same thing applies to some extent about this variable hawk. The idea that it picked up, this is one of the things I hear, I've heard about it forever with variable, like there's been more than one record, right, over time.
That's the part that bothers me about the decision, is the more than one record part. I think there will be more.
Picked up by, you know, it was hanging in with some Swainson's hawks and it migrated with the Swainson's hawks up. And it's, you know, it's coming from South America and it's going to, you know, it lands in sort of Swainson's hawk country and it makes complete sense because it just picked up with these hawks and moved. I'm like, when does that happen? Like, so, you know, so I'm sitting there, you know, like a moderately migratory, somewhat migratory bird. I'm like, hey, look, these scarlet tanagers are moving north. You know, I'm going to hang in with these guys, you know, and oh man, I wound up in, you know, Michigan. And there's, again, it's a good story and it makes some level of logical sense where we buy into it because of the logic. But it is so weirdly to me, like, improbable and not logical in my mind that I cannot understand that as even an explanation. Therefore, if you just say, oh, hawks just wander willy-nilly and every so often they're going to land in some weird place thousands of miles away, okay, That's all right.
Okay, so that's where I am with Variable Hawk. To take, if you don't mind us taking that, to picking that one apart here a little bit.
Let's say that this thing just, I mean, there are certain populations are moderately migratory, right? Sort of medium, short to medium distance migrants, it seems like. And I think the high Puna ones are the most
migrants.
Oh, really? I thought they were more migratory.
No, Puna Hawks are.
They're the most resident?
Yeah, I would say so, because their habitat doesn't change much at all year to year, like one season to the next. It's not like the Patagonian ones.
Okay. Right. Like you would think that those would move more. Yeah.
Yeah.
At any rate, regardless, there are these moderately, I guess what I was thinking of was the southern more ones, not the Puna ones, but the more southerly ones. But that's what I don't get, right? Is like there are other birds like that are less migratory that end up in the wrong place that, you know, that we accept that they just end up in the wrong place and then they knock around and are seen. But I mean, this is what, at least the second, third, maybe fourth variable hawk that has turned up.
I think it's just two, isn't it?
I can think of two. I wasn't sure if there might be an additional one or two.
And they're long lived, so I don't even know if it could be one. You know, that's.
But I thought I the two no records idea. Were pretty far apart, but
at least 20 years. But
yeah, seems unlikely.
Seems unlikely.
Yeah. At any rate, I think hawks have shown us. Like, I can understand your reservations with Gunnlaugs hawk more just from a habitat standpoint. The odds of seeing something so completely out of habitat makes more sense to me than seeing a hawk out of range. But, you know, I don't know. It seems to me like hawks can do anything, you know, like they're sort of the new hummingbirds, the new, you know, like they just turn up anywhere.
I mean, you know, the thing is
that black hawks and stellar sea eagles and, you know.
Yeah, but they're within the bounds of like, this is like a Patagonian and, you know, and mountain species. We don't really know how migratory they are. They're migratory to some extent, but there's not much info on them. So, you know, if you're gonna pick something that's gonna wind up just willy-nilly wandering around, I'm more thinking like those quasi-resident birds in the tropics in Central America that, you know, just sort of motor about, and, you know, like crane hawks and black hawks, and all that makes sense to me.
And some of those are much closer to the border as well.
Yeah, I guess. Much closer to the border. And I think they just move. We don't know that they move that much. I would not be surprised like if a zone-tailed hawk showed up in, you know, central Manitoba or something. I'd be like, yep, you know. But this thing, it just, and it's a pretty hawk too. You know, I'm like, people keep hawks and do all sorts of crazy stuff with, you know, the raptor people, you know. And I don't know how many wild flying Harris's hawks you've seen, but I bet you've seen more than one, as I have, you know.
And you mean like obvious escapees?
Yeah, escapees.
Yeah. Well, all the ones I've seen have had jesses or been with humans that were the keeper.
Right. I mean, I've seen them flying around with jesses, but completely, you know, away from a keeper, you know, where it's just it got loose.
I've seen that once, yeah.
Right. So yeah. They're the most commonly kept, I guess. Raptor. But there are people that seem to kind of also just collect raptors that don't fly them, you know? And
yeah,
if you're gonna have some cool raptor that's probably easy to get, it'd be, you know, the variable hawk or the old redback hawk, you know, because Argentina, I mean, a lot of the pet trade comes, at least used to come out of Argentina, you know, with the burrowing parakeets, monk parakeets, all that stuff. Some of the biggest markets for wild birds are in the Chaco, where people go and buy. To me, it's just like, I don't know, man. You know, I mean, I would be like a solitary eagle showing up in Southern California. I'd be like, cool. Wow. What a record. But this one doesn't strike me, you know,
So it's not the idea. It's not the idea that a variable hawk couldn't show up out of range necessarily, but that the idea that it could be a captive bird that clouds whether there's actually any sort of vagrancy event occurring here.
Yeah, and also, it maybe it's because of where it's at, you know, and you don't. I mean, I don't know. I expect white-tailed hawk would be more likely to go shooting about. You know, again, because it's closer. I mean, if we're talking about the place where they moved, it's so far away from where we are. I mean, folks don't realize that Patagonia is as far south, you know, or let's even southern Chile is as far south from the equator.
So,
as
do we
Oregon
know that this was
north of the equator?
Do you know that this individual was from that far south?
No, but that's, you know, the idea is it came from the population that moves.
Well, but let's say
north,
it didn't.
They're very
sedentary.
Well, sedentary, and there's not that many. I mean,
looking at the range,
Colombia or something.
Right. They certainly range into Colombia along the Andes. You know, once you get sort of down to maybe central southern Ecuador, it looks like they have a broader range. I don't know what their numbers are. And then I would imagine their numbers increase as they get further south from there. But at any rate, yeah. And maybe we shouldn't dwell on this one in particular because there are some other headlines in this report.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go on record. I bet there's going to be more of these. And I bet my hunch is that these are wild birds and we're going to see more variable hawks. Gunnlaugs hawk, I don't know what to make of that, but hopefully time will tell with the variable hawk.
How about ship assistance and catbird, black catbird, for example? It was on the ship. And
I mean, I don't really care personally, like in terms about ship assists, I should say. Like to me, you know, please finish what you're saying.
One of the things that came up with ship assistance is that some of the members are basically like, I don't like this ship assistance stuff. You know, it doesn't ring true as vagrancy. But the rules are basically ABA, ship assistance is okay, you know, if it wasn't in a cage. So therefore, you know, there's also been a talk of like, let's all get on the same page with what we're voting on, almost like, you know, like the legal scholars, you know, have to sometimes go, hey, you know, like, how does the law work?
There's
that element of
what's the guiding principle here,
right? Yeah. So I think there's a bit of that going on
too. Yeah, and I guess that's what I kind of meant when I said I don't care. To me, it's like there are so many ships now sprinkled all over, you know, the oceans, mm-hmm. that, you know, trying to determine if a bird was assisted by resting on a ship for part of its journey to me seems just like there's such a big part of the landscape. And by that, I mean landscape, you know, like that it's hard to sort out. It's another thing if you can prove the bird was restrained or strongly have some evidence that strongly suggests that it was restrained and fed and couldn't leave the boat that it was on, then maybe that's something different. But if it's a free-flying bird kind of hopping around from ship to ship and ends up in the U.S., I mean, who cares, you know?
Right. And one of the very cool things about the committee or, you know, being on these kinds of, I think it works too, where if you're in a records committee, is that I think everybody was pretty well like, Gunnlaugs hawk, let's go for it. And, you know, I was the stick in the mud that said, hold on a second, you know, and we brought in some more opinions also, you know, I think Arturo Kirkconnell, there may have been another opinion somewhere, you know, Arturo from Cuba, Cuban expert. And he was like, you know what? I don't like it either. And then the several members of the committee said, you know, if it's causing such concern by people who sort of know this bird or whatever, you know, why accept something that is sort of, you know, let's wait, you know,
like I guess
maybe
my
there's two or three in the future, okay, that's one thing. Or if we start finding Cooper socks that look like Gunnlaugs.
Well, that was going to be my other question, is was anybody actually able to produce imagery of Cooper's hawks that looked really actually similar to this particular bird?
Peter Pyle got into it pretty much with the photos that were online on eBird. And he said, you know, there are kind of a lot of the elements that are shown by this bird are shown by some photos of a certain small proportion of male Cooper's hawks. And he said they're more commonly in Florida, which he wondered if there could be some genetic kind of like history there with Cuba. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. But he too, he was like, you know, this is kind of intriguing. We just sort of assume that Cooper's hawks look a certain way. But when you look at photographs, there's a lot of variation, some of them with gray going all the way down the chest, you know, and not what we tend to see. So he procured some, but admittedly, nothing looked exactly like this bird, which looks very much like a Cooper's hawk, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean,
Guenlocks, yeah.
And one of the things I thought too is like structurally, I think Guenlocks hawks look different, you know, if they're flying, if, you know, you could sort of see the more squared off tail, but you can't see it on this bird.
Right.
So
perched raptors, you know, always trickier.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I mean, as much as people might dislike this situation, I think the cool part is like, well, let's go start looking at Cooper's hawks more and see if we can match anything up, you know, like over time. And if the Florida Cooper's hawks are actually different in some way, that's actually cool learning that's happening, you know, from this one record, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah. Time, she will tell, hopefully, will be more revealing. So that report, came out, the end of 2023, I think it was. There was a, that we were looking at just there. There's another link I just provided, Al. There was an updated report from March 5th on the ABA site, which noted a couple other newsworthy bits, including the addition of four other species to the list, which was southern lapwing, which is one we've talked about on this trip before and was kind of sticking in our craw. Happy to see that finally added. Kentish plover, Ainley's storm petrel, and European goldfinch. An interesting one. A lot of people outside the Midwest might not realize that these birds are increasingly established in certain places. Actually, in New York, they're pretty well established in places there. They turn up. I've seen them around here, Philadelphia area, a couple times. But in Wisconsin and Illinois, there's actually established populations of these things that seem to be certainly stable and perhaps even growing. So I don't know. I have to say, I think it's kind of a fun addition. Yeah, Doug talks about how they're very routine there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, a couple of things of these new ones. We talked about lapwing. Kentish plover, it was a bird in Alaska, and there was the idea of like, okay, how do you tell a Kentish plover from a snowy plover? They used to be lumped, right, way back in the day. But one of the cool things that came out of this one is Marky Mutchler put together photographs and then did a little illustration showing how they differ in their face pattern, how much dark they have in the kind of lore section. And I thought, like, finally, we got like something to hang your hat on.
Some new ID info.
Some new ID info. And hopefully she will publish that somewhere. But, you know, apart from some slight differences in the color of the colorful areas in the breeding season, you know, other things that might, I think that was really cool. And I know that there are some records in the Northeast of snowy plovers that have been thought to possibly have been Kentish, but how does one know? I think it'd be a great time to reevaluate some of those, and even some of those Great Lakes birds. Like, were they truly snowies or were they Kentish? You know, we might find that they're, you know, kind of like
another record or two elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sort of like the European sandwich tern phenomenon that, you know, some of these wacky vagrants were, in fact, not sandwich, but maybe the Euro sandwich, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Cabot's
is the one we have, yeah.
Right. And then sandwich is the old word one.
Yeah. Yeah, sandwich. Yeah. Except they haven't been split formally by everybody yet, so it's kind of confusing.
It is interesting to see I've seen several new ID bits coming out about difficult species pairings or difficult groups. Mm-hmm. Sibley had that piece on the terns. I think it was in North American Birds that he published that.
Yeah.
This thing you mentioned about Kentish versus snowy, And I've heard about a couple other things where it's like, in some ways, it feels like we've kind of closed the books on like identification of birds in North America. But man, there's still still new threads to tug at and stones to overturn.
And the non-accepted in this, you know, link that you just sent, you know, Antipodes albatross, which is a wandering type, and that was not accepted, not because there wasn't a wandering type albatross seen. There was, but we can't figure out at this point in time if it was an Antipodes or the, you know, Tristan, which is highly unlikely in California, much rarer. But the fact that one can't tell one from the other yet, at least based on the photos, made it difficult. I mean, I'm quite fine saying Antipodes albatross makes sense to me. Eurasian goshawk is another one that the idea of goshawks is usually Eurasian versus American. It's actually relatively easy in some respects, but in other respects, you get these young female, sort of sub-adult female Americans that look much more barred underneath, like Euro goshawks, and you're like, oh, you know. And the one that was in Alaska is a white goshawk, and that was really wild because, you know, there's a white morph of the Asian version of the of the Eurasian goshawk, and it makes sense, but it could also be a leucistic goshawk,
right? Just an anomaly within
an anomaly,
and
maybe even like a gerfalcon. It was not a good picture, you know. So
yeah,
there's all that, and then this house martin thing, like, you know, how do you take Asian versus Siberian versus Western house martins? And this was a bird on the St. Pierre and Miquelon, you know, that you mentioned earlier. And it even though it's like closer to where Western it lives, you know how it is. Those islands, it's sometimes like the Siberian one is more likely.
Right.
It's like out there, you know how it is. Like vagrants don't follow the rules that we expect them to follow.
Right. We have our expectations. The birds don't necessarily know about those or care.
I mean, that's what makes finding a vagrant sometimes so crazy, right? Like, I mean, you guys have seen Vega gulls in Pennsylvania, and it's like, you know, we have a hard time, you know, people have a hard time getting them in British Columbia, where it makes way more sense. You know?
Right.
But vagrancy.
Well, that's interesting. It's I have to say, I've always enjoyed following these ABA Checklist Committee reports because it does force you to think about some of these things, some of these identification issues that you wouldn't have thought of before, or just to think about some of these species that might be pretty unfamiliar to people, and think about whether they're actually possible in your home area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, definitely. I've learned a lot, you know. Sometimes in my mind, I think like, why do I sign up for this stuff? You know, I got so much going on, you know, and yet I do learn a lot, and I just love learning new stuff. And also just interesting to learn how people think about records, and they're all great minds, birding minds.
Distributed also throughout the ABA area, right? Like that's partly by design, as you got people from Alaska, from California, from New York, from Florida.
That's the only reason I'm on there, is just because I fit the geographic.
Great Basin. I see Lauren Harder is coming on board. She's in the Great Basin area. So a whole bunch of interesting.
We definitely need more women on there, but if you think you can do the job of reviewing some of these records, let ABA Checklist Committee know.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and yeah, I think another thing that came up this week, Al, big news project that you have been following is
a follower.
Yeah, this B10K, the Bird 10,000 Genomes Project. But there was a paper that came out related to this project, yeah?
Yeah. It's Complexity of Avian Evolution Revealed by Family-Level Genomes by Josephine Stiller, and like seemingly 30 or 40 other authors.
Yeah. long that, list of other folks.
Yeah, that long list of other folks, which doesn't mean they didn't, you know, we can't get into all the names in here, but you know, there's some folks that from North America, Europe, Asia, everywhere that were involved in this big work. And I don't know, did you saw the little picture of all the bird, you know, sort of the new phylogeny? Did anything that came up for you, or you sort of kind of go, oh, a new one of these? I don't, you know, let's see.
No, I mean, I read the a couple different articles kind of summarizing this paper. The graphics were really cool, and I mostly looked at these like these orders and looked a bit at, I mean, this only came out yesterday, so I haven't even really been able to fully digest it, but like reading the summary, I guess, and I posted this on my Facebook page, and I think because the image was actually like of a bird of paradise, people thought like I didn't know what I was talking about or whatever, but I was like, what I posted was like, the more we learn, the more clear it is that nobody knows, you know, WTF, what a Watson is, you know? And I think that that's kind of a cool, or, you know, or what to make of a Watson is what I said, because they, you know, we know what it is, but what it's related to or how closely continues to be enshrouded in mystery. And in a way, I think that I love that, because this thing is clearly distinct and very, very different than all other birds. So I love that that kind of actually is still the case.
Although we know who its closest relatives are, you know, based on this, but it is like a orphan branch. It's kind of like it's not close to anything, yet we know what it's closest to, kind of thing, you know? Yeah, it's a weirdo. That this actually proves it's a weirdo. It's, and which you didn't need to have proved in some respects, but it's interesting that it confirms this weirdness.
Yeah, I guess, and I need to, as I say, I need to dig into this more still. But I think, I guess I like that that was confirmed. I guess was that it was. It is such a distinct, strange entity. But I mean, some of the other groupings I saw were surprising to me. They'd applied some new names to some of these groups, and I don't know if those will stick over time or not.
But. Right. You know, and as more of so the techniques get better and the mathematical techniques to analyze the data get better, it starts getting more solid. You know what I mean? It flips around a lot less than it used to. You know, you used to get these new papers where everything was, hold on a minute, you know, now things like, you know, the idea that we have parrots and falcons closely related to the passerines and in turn, you know, related to the sariemas, that is like every one of them comes out with that now, you know, like it's like starting to be solidified, you know?
Yeah.
So you get that kind of thing. What I found kind of really cool about this whole new thing is like, so they're computational algorithms. They're using some new stuff that I don't even, you know, I won't even pretend to know what is going on in that, but it allows them to actually look through the data and figure out places that things sort of, in a sense, don't fit, you know, based on the, you know, all the information altogether. And one thing they found that there was a chunk of DNA that instead of kind of recombining and changing over time, like most DNA bits do, and, you know, groups of genes and so forth, this part stayed static for like millions of years. And that, like, if you can almost think about it, it's as if that static nature of that bit of DNA makes things that are not related seem like they're related because they share that bit of static DNA. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it hasn't been changing. So then they were able to identify this bit and go, hold on a second. Like, okay, let's see what happens if we take that into account. And one of the things that happened was that the flamingos and grebes, which, again, those have been thought of as being closely related to each other. Well, again, most closely related to each other, but really not that closely related. They came out as a group, which is fine. A lot of everybody's been sort of saying that for a while. But how they relate to all of the rest of the modern, like newer birds, the neo-aves, is now different in this new paper. And essentially all of the birds that aren't the really old ones, like ratites.
You were talking about the paleognaths and the neonaths, right?
Right.
And this is within the neonaths you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. Except, you know, you also have like the chickens and geese are sort of this early branch. So those are early, but the next group, everything else from like, you know, we're talking loons to swifts to trogons to warblers to pelicans to pigeons, everything else. The birds that are sort of outside of that group are the flamingos and grebes. Like they're sister to the entire rest of the sort of more recent birds. And you're like, that's huge. You know, like it really gets at the fact that there were, you know, there was some crazy history going on there. And I thought that was really cool. But the fact that they were able to figure that out based on this sort of new analysis and sort and an understanding that there was a set of genes that was kind of not functioning as expected means that this going forward, they're going to be able to figure out more places where genes aren't expected and create a better and better and better phylogeny, I hope, as time goes by and as more species go into the mix. So I thought that was pretty cool, you know?
That is wild. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at that tree now as you're saying this, Trinit, and understanding what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, they've given them, you know, new names. So I guess they're called the grebes and flamingos are the Mirandornithes, and their sister to everything else. And in the past, they were kind of put together more with the doves, pigeons, doves. And in fact,
yeah, not doves, sand grouse, and mesites.
Yeah.
Prior.
I think the other thing that I kind of stuck out with me is like the group that includes they're called strisors. It's the swifts, hummingbirds, and nightjars, right? So all kind of weirdo little birds with like tiny feet and legs, you know, sort of you know, a lot of aerial stuff going on there, super aerial birds. Their sister, like sort of their closest relatives, are a whole bunch of birds that are mostly marine, like pelicans, the tube noses, the penguins, the loons, the tropic birds, you know, and I guess it's the sunbittern, forget that part, but it's just mostly marine birds. Then they're sort of sister.
It is sunbittern, I think, yeah.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Kagu, yeah.
Kagu, yeah. Isn't that weird?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, they
So Chytura pelagica might actually make a little more sense than we
make
thought,
more sense, right? You know, and yeah, yeah. And then when you start thinking of like, you know, storm petrels are sort of like swifts of the sea, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense as well. Yeah. And to be clear, they're most closely related, but they're still millions of years of difference in evolution between those groups. But to think that, I don't know, you know, that a nightjar is not that, is more closely related to a penguin than it is to a owl, to me is amazing.
That is, you know, bizarre.
And I think the last point that really is cool is that they have the, you know, based on the difference in genes, they can estimate when some of these branches kind of happened. And this KPG boundary, which is the extinction of the dinosaurs, essentially, that Cretaceous, end of Cretaceous boundary, is the point at which all of the branching happens in birds. Like the dinosaurs, the big old dinosaurs, and, you know, and then you know, the smaller dinosaur species all go extinct after this major event and birds run wild.
Just like after proliferate like crazy.
Right. So
branching into new niches and.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as if you scrape clean the world of so many creatures and birds suddenly realize, oh, I can do that. You know, I can peck on a tree and I can, you know, walk around on the ground and pick seeds and all that kind of stuff. You know, it just sort of goes insane. I think that was pretty cool. You know, there are other time element things that also happen, but that's the one that stands out. So it's pretty neat paper, you know. Hmm. And I think you're alluding to this bigger project too that's going on, that they're part of this B10K project, where essentially they're trying to sequence every single bird in the world to get at the entire genetic history of birds. And they have multiple phases. So the first is like sequence all the orders, then sequence all the families, then sequence all the genera. That's phase three. And then at the end, phase four is sequence the remaining species. And they have about 2,000 species already sequenced. So it's pretty amazing. You know, they've got all the orders done. And I think they've got most of the families. I think just, you know, a few families, and then, you know, much more work needed in the genera and species.
So I forget if they say here when this project might come to completion.
Well, you don't know, right? Because it's sort of like, you know, trying to get your 10,000 birds.
Right.
In your life list.
You finish it when you finish it.
You finish it when you finish it. But I think that once you get to, the genera is like three quarters done, I think. So that's
gonna
be major, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Just like, I think that was one of the things you had alluded to earlier, was that, like, you know, soon we're going to there's been so much speculation for so long about the relationships between these birds and what goes where and what evolved first. And like, it's just crazy to think that we're going to know relatively soon.
Yeah, relatively soon. And, you know, I used to think it was funny when people used to say, like, when are they going to stop shifting the order in the field guides? I think, you know, this people who sell field guides are making big money from this, as if like there was some
wonderful conspiracy people were making gazillions off of. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think either group knows of each other in a sense, you know, like,
right.
I'm sure in fact, it's the opposite. Probably the field guide people are like, ah, dang it. You know, like, got to rearrange this stupid thing now, you know? Like,
yeah, exactly. We just laid out that field guide and now this.
Yeah. It's the opposite. It probably costs some money.
Yeah.
I know, but we're getting there. As viewers of this stuff, you know, and like it is getting way more solid, and you're just also, you know, the fact that there's a group working on the gulls, the entire genome of multiple gull populations, you know, one of the most crazy, difficult and complicated sets of hybridizing creatures on Earth. The fact that they're tackling that is amazing to me, you know.
Yeah,
like in a few years we might actually know what these populations are doing, like, you know, because we always hypothesize, oh, you know, it's probably a hybrid, you know, or
it will be kind of sad when we lose that. Yeah. You know, like, because it's occupied a considerable amount of time and headspace and just, you know, it's triggered so much, you know, well, hard thinking.
The Gulls of North America Facebook site, Soriomar, is going to shut down. There'll be nothing to talk about.
I have faith that Amar will come up with some new material to keep everybody on their toes.
But yeah. I do think, though, that we won't still know what any one gull that you're watching is.
That is true.
You will just know the possibilities, right? You'll be like, oh, yeah, you know, actually, Thayer's gull does actually hybridize a little bit with herring gull, you know, or there's at least some evidence of that. So then you would, genetic evidence of that, then you kind of have it as your, oh, okay, could be, you know, it might make it even more talk worthy. I just know enough about gull people that no matter what happens, there will be more talk about gulls.
There's only going to be more chatter, not less.
So more chatter, right. Yeah. These people are nuts, and you know, I don't want to be associated with them any longer.
I was going to say any longer. Say right smack in the middle. Yeah.
Good fun.
I don't know if you saw the quote I put in there, Al. That's what I was had read about the Hwatzen, was that they were still wrestling. I guess they know its position relative to what they know of everything else. But anyway.
Yeah, that it's an orphan, you know, I guess it, what they might be saying is that if maybe they get more data, it could shift, perhaps.
Yeah.
Given that quote, you know, even with such a huge amount of genome data, one branch remains a mystery.
We should dedicate one entire episode to the Hwatzen. Yeah. Such a ridiculous bird.
Right. Yeah.
It's funny, like, you know, Kristen and I saw a few of those in the Llanos years ago, and she doesn't really have any concept of what that bird is taxonomically, but man, did it stick with her, just like cartoon character of a bird. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just such a crazy one.
It's a crazy one. And I guess if somebody hasn't seen this, there's a few things to talk about here, because one, like, if you see pictures of reconstruction of Archaeopteryx, it looks like a Hwatzen, right?
This is a modern day Archaeopteryx bird. Yeah.
Because the reason is somebody said, like, okay, this was the oldest bird ever at that time, right? Archaeopteryx. And then what are we going to make it look like? And there's like, well, let's pick the weirdest bird we can think of. Hwatzen, you know? So it's like, that's why it looks like that. And we had no info that it actually looked like that. But, and the other thing is, like, it crawls around as a youngster with hooks, basically little claws that it has on its wings, like this weirdo lizard, which they are.
They really dinosaur, are. Kind of, you know? Yeah.
And then don't they have like multiple stomachs?
I think they have like four stomachs or something.
Like a cow, right?
Yeah. They're like a ruminant, basically.
Ruminant, right?
Yeah. And
so it's just like, what the hell? You know, and apparently I remember, like, in the Napo, when we were out there, the locals said, oh, yeah, nobody eats the Hwatzen, you know, because they look basically like the easiest thing to ever to like hunt, because they're just sitting there and they're slow. And they, but it's like, oh, no, they taste like crap kind of thing, because they probably, you know, it's like just awful tasting, weird thing, you know.
Just pulling up the Hwatzen, it's like they have a unique, they have two chambers, I guess, unique digestive system, much like cattle and ruminants. And they ferment foliar material, leaf material, in their stomachs.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, they're kind of producing a weird, you know, cud of like fermented leaves in their stomach, which apparently produces a lot of methane. So they spend a lot of time burping as well. Huh.
Wow. Sounds like some people I know.
Yeah, they said, well, thanks. Yeah, they often the birds have sort of a manure-like odor as a result of this.
Oh, that's why you don't eat them, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they call them the stink bird. Yeah.
And for our British listeners, methane, right? Methane.
Oh, very good. Good call there. Yeah. Anyway, we should scoot here. We are running on... into the next hour here, and I think we both got other stuff to do.
We don't want to be talking methane with folks.
It's true. When you reach the point in the podcast where you're discussing methane and stink birds, perhaps it's time to let everybody move on to other pursuits.
Right, something better to do with our lives. Well, thank you for wasting a certain amount of your time with us.
Indeed. Right on. Well, anything you want the good folks to know about before we move on here, Al?
Molly is in Cuba right now with our Tudor Kirkconnell, a trip that, you know, is is out there and I'm getting the reports. So that's awesome. And I'm hoping they go back in December if we get enough people. So Cuba, next door neighbor, you know, it's the other country with a C, right? Not Canada, Cuba.
That's right. Nice. Nice. Yeah. I would tell folks to check out our multiple Columbia offerings coming up in the early part of 2025. The first one is to Amazonia and the Whites for White Sand Specials with Phil Sean. Then we got the Santa Martas after that with Josh Coville. And then Molly's got a couple offerings, including High Times in the Central Cordillera, along with another trip to the Choco in the Western Andes. All these trips have got space still. So check them out.
Times? Is this like a drug thing or what's going on?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that necessarily. I mean, coffee. I can't speak. The trip has not occurred yet, so I can't say what will happen, you know, and what happens in Colombia can stay in Colombia for those that are of that mentality. But High Times, because there's some time spent at elevation, Alvaro.
Yeah, you're going to get sued by Cheech and Chong, I think.
Those are some good movies. Nice Dreams, Up in Smoke. Man, those were classics.
I wonder if one sees those now, if they've aged really badly. I don't know, but as a teenager, they were like, you know, whoa, look at these guys.
The Corsican Brothers. You ever see the Corsican Brothers? That was a pretty classic. Oh, that's worth watch. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, we digress. All right, folks. Thanks so much for listening. Al, you have a good day. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.